Welcome to the Spotlight. A new study shows U.S. police killings are undercounted by more than half over the past four decades, resulting in the death figure being cut off by over 17,000. The study conducted at the University of Washington raises questions about racial bias among medical examiners and highlights the lack of reliable national record keeping. It compared death certificates with data from organizations that tracked U.S. police killings between 1980 and 2018. Findings also pointed to disproportionate killings of African Americans who were fatally shot at a rate of 3.5 times more than their white counterparts. Co-lead author of the study says they realized a vast discrepancy while reviewing police violence data after the 2020 murder of George Floyd. According to the paper, the undercounted killings are not necessarily missing, but are miscategorized. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent, Colin Campbell, who's with us from Washington. Colin, what do these numbers mean?
Well, these numbers mean that they are not really dedicated to understanding just how deleterious police involvements are when it comes to shootings and its impact on the black community and communities of color, as we see that there are disproportionate ways that communities of color are affected by police shootings. Now, of course, this is not a new conversation. This is something that has been discussed for decades, but still we haven't seen that will coming from politicians or from the police to really track these shootings more accurately. What does that do? Well, that sets in place white hegemony, that power struggle that whites have struggled and wanted to maintain throughout decades since the founding of this country. And they do it using the police force. And then we see that it goes to another level on the stretch or the lengths of fatalities that black people and communities of color suffer at the hands of police. And so what there needs to be is reform to how these records are being collected, the reports that are being made, and the repercussions that happen when there is a police shooting and someone dies, and it's very unclear whether or not that shooting was necessary. The high-profile cases, we do hear about those, like George Floyd, not a shooting, but still a police killing. But there are so many other shootings that happen across the country that go unreported, that don't get the media spectacle that other cases do. And these still leave behind shattered lives, families, friends, brothers, sisters, you name it. These people are all victims of police shootings, and then their families are also victimized as well. So this really has to be taken a lot more seriously, something that hasn't been done in the history of the U.S., and it's just now being revealed. I would suppose that there are going to be advocacy groups that will really try to campaign to the president to take a stand on this, whether or not it's something that he has his Justice Department adjust, at least federally, and then hopefully it trickles down to states and then local municipalities. But something needs to be done as of yesterday, in fact.
All right, thanks a lot. Colin Campbell joining us from Washington, D.C. Our guests joining us on tonight's Spotlight are former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg, joining us from Washington, D.C. and Professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, Gerald Horn, who's with us from Houston, Texas.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, let's start off with Mr. Horn in Houston. Welcome to the program here on Press TV Spotlight. This report found that between 1980 and 2018, more than 55% of deaths from police violence, that's over 17,000 in total, were either misclassified or went unreported. Plain and simple, is this a cover-up?
It is a cover-up. It's a tragedy. It's also a crime against humanity. As you may know, the Black community through our organizations have been clamoring for a United Nations human rights investigation of this quasi-genocidal pattern that has been inflicted upon the Black community. And I urge and encourage the international community to move with all due deliberate speed to intervene, because what's going on cannot be allowed to continue. You should also know that in today's newspapers, there was another stunning article about the fact that as of 2020 alone, there were thousands, 70,000 cases of missing Black girls, girls under the age of 18. Where have they gone? Where have they disappeared to? At the same time, Black children only are 14% of the nation's children population, but they're 31% of the children that are missing. What's going on in the United States is obviously an outgrowth of slavery. It's obviously an outgrowth of the unresolved issues that followed slavery, speaking of the hated apartheid system known as Jim Crow. And you should know that that system only began to retreat because of international pressure. And I dare say that today's tragedies will likewise only retreat under unremitting international pressure.
Matthew Fogg in Washington, D.C., do you agree with Mr. Horn? This is an effort to conceal the truth. Even so, the figures are still too high anyways, aren't they?
Oh, the figures are staggering. I mean, when you look at the numbers of the percentage of African Americans that live in the United States, and you're talking about the numbers, the disproportionate numbers of those that are missing or having some type of a negative impact in their life, it's crazy. I mean, yes, I agree 100%. Until this country recognizes that it has a racial issue that is perpetuated from slavery and all the way back, and that the country is still very much divided on this issue, we're going to have problems. It's definitely in law enforcement, that's for sure.
Let's go back to Mr. Horn. The study, it discovers that Black Americans are 3.5 times more likely to be killed by police than white Americans, and Hispanic people are killed at a ratio of 1.8 times higher than non-Hispanic white people. The review of data shows that many fatal police encounters are misclassified, but often most often when the victim is Black or Hispanic. Again, the minorities here bear the brunt of all this. Tell us more, please.
Well, it's interesting. The study that you mentioned references killings by the police. But keep in mind, there are other cases that even this study, as significant and profound as it is, did not encompass. Recall that just a few years ago, not far from where I'm sitting in Houston, Texas, there was the case of the young Black woman, Sandra Bland, who was pulled over by the police because of a traffic violation, was taken to jail, and apparently was so harassed and so traumatized by being in prison that she hung herself. So that would be classified as a suicide, although it's fair to say that the proximate cause of her death was her maltreatment and mistreatment by the police. You should also note that just recently in the U.S. Congress in Washington, D.C., there was an attempt to pass a change in the law, the so-called George Floyd Policing Act. You referenced George Floyd, the Black man in May 2020 in Minnesota, who was killed on camera at the hands, or I should say at the knee, on the neck, administered by a Minnesota police officer. But what's striking is that the Republican Party, the opposition party, did not negotiate in good faith. They basically claimed in a demagogic fashion that if the federal government wants to hold back funds to police departments that use chokeholds, which is an illegal way to restrain a potential suspect, which oftentimes leads to that suspect's death, or if the police department continues to use no-knock warrants, that's when the police don't knock on the door. They just come through your door without knocking and start shooting anybody who resists. the Republicans claim that if you try to restrain and cut off funds from police departments who use such crazy tactics, that that's something that will not go down well with them. And so the bill died. And so presumably, police departments are still authorized in many cities to use chokeholds, to use no-knock warrants, and this will continue to cause an escalation and rise of the deaths of citizens, particularly Black American citizens.
Matthew Fogg, past studies have analyzed underreporting of fatal police incidents and how Black Americans disproportionately die from police violence, but those previous researches, they were conducted over much shorter time periods. This report, it covered 40 years. Do you believe that the manner of conduct has been the same basically for decades?
Well, I've been in law enforcement for 30 years. I've also been a police expert on law enforcement race issues for about 20 years. I've won a major case against the U.S. Department of Justice myself, fighting racism internally behind the blue wall of silence. I've been there. I've seen how officers can conduct themselves in ways that certainly is not part of our training, but it becomes a culture once you get on the job. And the problem is within law enforcement, and yes, the report is 100% hitting on. I mean, this goes way back. Like I said, for all of the years that I've been in the U.S. Marshals and was a member in law enforcement, worked with dragnet operations all over the country, I had a chance to actually see it in place. And I'm with an organization like right behind me called Blacks in Government, and I'm also was the front page of a news article on my other side that says Bigots with Badges, which is my book that's coming out. But the bottom line is this. Racism is infiltrated. The FBI came out and did a report and indicated how many of these subversive, these very, what we call right-wing racist groups have infiltrated law enforcement. So it is a problem in America. It goes all the way back to the Hoover administration, back when Hoover over the FBI. I mean, we know that law enforcement has been a tool that has been used to actually, as Chief Justice Warren said, who's now deceased, he said the police officer is more powerful than the President of the United States because they have a right to forfeit a person's freedom, their property, or their life at any given time, according on what they perceive their discretion. So this is a problem, and it's a problem that we have to address in America. I've tried to do it with my job. I didn't become one of those police officers that waited until I retired, but I took on the system right when I was there and actually saw these things that we're talking about now, the chokeholds and what happened with George Floyd. And we go even New York City Police Department when the mayor de Blasio spoke out about telling his Black sons to be careful, and the whole half the police department turned their backs on him. So it is a problem in America, and I think right now with the whole issue of Black Lives Matter, these reports that are coming out, it's saying that this is just not conjured up stuff, but this is real, and we're going to have to figure out a way to deal with it, whether it's in Congress or whether it's marching, but it's got to be dealt with.
Mr. Horn, the study brings forth a grim reality here. Despite years of scrutiny, criticism, protests, calls for reform, no government agency tracks how often law enforcement officers in America kill people. Now, if that's the case, how can anyone ever follow up on these findings or pursue a path that leads somewhere in terms of making a change?
Well, that's a very good question. However, your audience should know that The Guardian, the London-based newspaper, interestingly enough, has been trying to keep statistics and figures on how many people are killed by the police in the United States of America, because obviously there are authorities in the United States of America that are not interested in collecting such data, because I assume they feel that it would be indicting them. Also, the Washington Post in the United States of America has tried as well to keep such figures. But to follow up on what your guest said, studies have shown that in Los Angeles, the second largest metropolis in the United States of America, in the sheriff's department, you have right-wing gangs that prey upon Black men in particular, and even have certain kinds of games that they play to show that they have basically harassed or otherwise intimidated or worse, injured or maimed Black men in particular. Obviously, this is a cofactor on the skyrocketing incarceration rates of black men in particular, although the rates for black women also are escalating sharply, the United States probably imprisons a higher percentage of its population than any other nation on planet Earth. And then there's the death penalty. Black people are more likely to be subjected to the death penalty, subjected to execution by the state, and they're more likely to be executed if they kill a white person than if they kill a person who is not defined as white. Now, obviously, this is outrageous. It should not be allowed to stand. But once again, I think that we'll need pressure from the international community in order for this system of inequality, this staggering crime against humanity, to somehow cease.
Matthew Fogg, let's talk about it. Mr. Horn just mentioned the issue of the judicial system. Let's talk about the much-seen police impunity in black deaths. As seen time and time again, the judicial system is mostly in favor of the police, especially if the victims, especially if the police are white, the victims are of a community of color. Why is this common practice in U.S. courts?
Well, it just shows how systemic racism is. I mean, it just shows you that across the board. I mean, again, I challenge the U.S. Department of Justice, most powerful law enforcement, probably organization in the world, because we as U.S. Marshals work under them. I challenged it for race discrimination. In 1998, I got a landmark verdict that said racism was systemic within the U.S. Marshals, and today I'm the class agent representing over 1,500 black U.S. Marshals, the same type of thing that is going on today. So what we have, we say, if it's happening internally, if I got to deal with a bigot with a badge working next to me, imagine what they're going to do to the public. So reality of it is that, yes, the court systems, everybody's in on it, and the reality of it is that until it becomes an issue in America where we start to address it, start to talk about it, it somewhat came out once this past administration, and we started having Black Lives Matter, and people started marching in the street. Then all of a sudden, that's where the George Floyd Protection Act came out. Now, the organization I'm with, Blacks in Government, we actually did a resolution, and we passed that resolution telling Congress we supported the George Floyd Protection Act. But it's so much more, because what has happened is we're now beginning to see how entrenched America is on these issues. And as these reports come out, people are now asking the question, well, how can this be in America when we're supposed to be a land that says we're the country of the free? We have to address the fact that in law enforcement, like I said, I'm an expert on the inside. I know what we do. And what I'm saying is, and the culture is such that when you speak up, you become a whistleblower. Actually, you become the bad guy. Once you start speaking up and saying, this has got to stop, it's got to end. We did the same thing with the war on drugs. We took the war on drugs and we built one of the largest prison industrial complexes the world has ever seen, but mainly on the backs of African Americans. When I started noticing that, I brought that up to my managers. I said, listen, we're gonna stop going into urban areas and making arrests. We're going to start going into some of these more affluent areas, these white areas, these areas where the most drugs and the best stuff comes from. He said, Fogg, if you go into those locations and you do that, he said, what's going to happen? They're going to have pushback. They're going to contact their congressman, their lawyer, their judge, whoever. He said, next thing you know, they're going to shut our operation down. So we have to understand it is internally. There are a lot of police officers, a lot of people recognize it. We see it. You don't have to wait for a report. You can actually see the studies, and you can look around you and see who actually goes to prison for these crimes and who don't, who gets a break or whatever, or privilege, we call it, in America. So it is a problem.
All right, Gerald Horn. Researchers, they identified places where misclassification of the deaths often occurred, noting that medical examiners or coroners who must fill out the cause of death when there's suspicion of foul play, including police violence, they can be embedded in or work for the police departments. Now, if the medical examiner, a coroner, or other certifier fails to indicate police involvement in the cause of death on the death certificate, the incident, it could be misclassified. How concerning are these findings?
Well, it's extremely concerning. And what you just mentioned points to a structural problem, a structural flaw in the criminal justice system. it's not only that the coroners and the medical examiners oftentimes work hand in glove with the police departments. These are their comrades, these are their colleagues, and they're very unlikely to present data that might be indicting of their comrades and colleagues. The same holds true for the prosecuting authorities. That is to say, prosecuting authorities are reluctant to bring criminal cases against police officers who break the law because they too work hand in glove. They too see the police officers as their comrades and colleagues. And then you turn to the law itself. Right now, in many jurisdictions in the United States of America, you have this regulation or law called qualified immunity. What that means is that a police officer, generally speaking, can kill, steal, or rape and not necessarily be found liable if someone wants to sue them for damages. It's also unlikely, I'm afraid to say, for them to be found guilty of a crime because of the structure of the law. Once again, we can't begin to understand this outrage unless you understand the system of slavery, unless you begin to understand that system, which basically equated black people with being akin to horses, mules, and cattle, not part of the human family. And to this very day, there's that lingering idea that black people were not part of the human family. And since there has not been a sufficient interrogation, not to mention excoriation, of that particular canard, that lie, that outrage, the system continues to persist.
And one quick question, get a final thought from Matthew Fogg. We were talking about the issue of medical examiners and coroners. The practices are showing that racism is occurring not just during the encounter itself, but even after the individual has passed away. Does this show how deeply embedded systemic racism is in different aspects of American life, most notably in issues pertaining to health?
Well, if someone said it's walking, breathing, driving while black, and death while black. And yes, I mean, the reality of it is that the country has not relinquished its past, and it continues to hold on to that past and the remnants of the past. And like I said, being in law enforcement, having been on the front lines, and having been wanting to be a part of an organization that would say equal justice. But when you're talking about racism in America, I mean, it's just not there. And we as black law enforcement officers, the other officers who recognize it, we owe an oath and a duty to this country and a service to this country to stand up and report it. But yes, you are correct. The disparities are there 100% in just about everything.
Thanks a lot. That's all the time we have. Allow me to thank my guests, former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg, joining us from Washington, D.C. Also thanks to Professor of African American Studies at University of Houston, Mr. Gerald Thorne, joining us from Houston, Texas. Also special thanks to you, our guests, for staying with us on this issue of Spotlight. It's good night for now and bye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
بل قالوا مثل ما قال الأولون.
Rather, they say like what the former people said.
قالوا أإذا متنا وكنا ترابا وعظاما أإنا لمبعوثون.
They said, when we have died and become dust and bones, are we indeed to be resurrected?
لقد وعدنا
have been promised this, we and our forefathers, before. This is not but legends of the former peoples.
بَلْ قَالُوا مِثْلَ مَا قَالَ الْأَوَّلُونَ.
Nay, but they say the like of what the ancients said.
قَالُوا أَإِذَا مِتْنَا وَكُنَّا تُرَابًا وَعِظَامًا أَإِنَّا لَمَبْعُوثُونَ.
They say, what, when we die and become dust and bones, shall we then be raised up again?
This fact, dear listeners, the fact that the unbelievers say, shall we be dead and become dust and bones and be raised again, this word has been mentioned 9 times from the tongue of the unbelievers to oppose the message of the prophets. They had no reasons or arguments to refute the prophets, so their only responses to the truth is denial. So, in the previous verses, those who denied the oneness and unity of the Almighty Allah and also resurrection were called to ponder the world of existence and the signs in the microcosm and macrocosm. And at the end, they were told, أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ. Have you then no senses or no intellects? Now, as these verses indicate, they have abandoned intellectual thinking and simply blindly imitate their ancestors and have dismissed the resurrection as tales of the ancients. That's why the holy verse says,
بَلْ قَالُوا مِثْلَ مَا قَالَ الْأَوَّلُونَ.
Nay, but they say the like of what the ancients said. Their argument about the denial of resurrection is also the same thing that the ancients used to say. Then, their exact words are reiterated in the next verse.
قَالُوا أَإِذَا مِتْنَا وَكُنَّا تُرَابًا وَعِظَامًا أَإِنَّا لَمَبْعُوثُونَ.
They say, what, then we die and become dust and bones, shall we then be raised up again? So, this question of the unbelievers shows the fact that they were rather ignorant, because if they had contemplated their creation in this world, and the possibility of their coming into existence from non-existence, then they would have been able to conclude that their resurrection from the dead would have been just as possible, and they would confess, eventually, that Almighty Allah is their creator. So, the unbelievers have nothing to answer the arguments of the prophets. They have no reasons, no arguments. And the only trick they have up their sleeves is denial. And they use this denial with wonder to express the fact that this is far from being true.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insight into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So the reason why they negated the fact of resurrection and monotheism is because they did not have intellect, or at least they did not use their intellect. They did not pay attention to life. They did not pay attention to death. And the alteration of the night and day, the Almighty Allah mentioned in the previous verses. About the Arabic word asatir, we should mention that it is the plural form of ustura, meaning a story or legend that is false. The word ustura itself is derived from the word satr, meaning line. So words that come one after another can be said to line up. In the next verse, they indicate that this is an unbelievable action. Such things have been promised to us and our forefathers before, so they are nothing but fables of men of old. The verse say, لَقَدْ وَعِدْنَا نَحْنُ وَآبَاؤُنَا هَذَا مِنْ قَبْلِ Certainly, we and our fathers have been promised this aforetime. إِنْ هَذَا إِلَّا أَسَاطِيرُ الْأَوَّلِينَ This is not but fables of the ancient. The Arabic word asatir is the plural form of ustura, meaning a story or legend that is false. The word ustura itself is derived from the word sat, meaning line, so words that come one after the other can be said to line up. So this verse says that they mean that their recreation, the reckoning, paradise and hell are nothing but mere fancy. These three verses altogether are here to tell us that they had nothing to answer to the reasonings of the prophets except denial and claiming that these are something like the fables of the ancient. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care. Goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavik, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Afghanistan's Deputy Minister of Information and Culture, Zabihullah Mujahid, says the United States has violated the country's airspace by its drones. He accused Washington of violating all international law, as well as a U.S.-Taliban peace deal signed between the two sides. He said the violations must be controlled and prevented.
Daesh presence in Afghanistan is not a big headache for us. Our forces are capable to uproot them here without receiving any foreign support. So the U.S. must honor the Doha deal and stop violating our space.
Mujahid's statement followed remarks by Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. He said the U.S. retained all necessary authorities to execute over-the-horizon counter-terrorism operations. Kirby also said Washington remains confident in its capabilities moving forward without speaking to specific rules of engagement surrounding airstrikes. He said there is currently no requirement to clear airspace with the Taliban. Analysts say since the U.S. did not fulfill its commitments to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, it is not expected to honor other pacts like U.S.-Taliban Doha deal.
Violating Afghanistan's sovereignty is not a new move by the U.S. It has repeatedly broken its promises, mainly when it comes to respecting our country's sovereignty, even during the rule of former governments here.
Given the U.S. is insisting on continuation of drone strikes in Afghanistan without coordination with the Taliban, the group has also warned the U.S. of negative consequences of continuing violation of Afghanistan's airspace. The U.S. claims that it targets terrorist groups like Daesh with its airstrikes. However, evidence on the ground shows that innocent Afghans are usually the real victims of such attacks. One of the last U.S. drone strikes was in Kabul on August 29 and killed 10 members of a family, including 6 children. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Just tip of the iceberg on how humiliatingly the Taliban defeated the U.S. in Afghanistan's battlefield. The Pentagon now has finally made admission of its failures, which enabled the Taliban to take over the entire Afghanistan so swiftly.
We need to consider some uncomfortable truths, that we didn't anticipate the snowball effect caused by the deals that the Taliban commanders struck with local leaders in the wake of the Doha Agreement, and that the Doha Agreement itself had a demoralizing effect on Afghan soldiers. And finally, that we failed to grasp that there was only so much for which and for whom many of the Afghan forces would fight. The fact that the Afghan army that we and our partners trained simply melted away, in many cases without firing a shot, took us all by surprise.
If today the world needs to know why the Taliban are back in power, all the world has to do is do a deep analysis of why 300,000 well-equipped Afghan army give up without a fight.
Contrary to what Pentagon admitted before the U.S. Senate Armed Service Committee, as many as 22 Republican senators introduced a bill in the Senate to probe the role of regional countries with particular focus on Pakistan in the military defeat of U.S.-led NATO troops in Afghanistan. The bill proposes sanctions on regional countries, particularly Pakistan and nascent Taliban government in Kabul. After Afghanistan, Pakistan has suffered the most. Tens of thousands of people died. An estimated $250 billion losses occurred to the economy in the long-drawn retaliatory insurgency in Pakistan for supporting a U.S. war on Afghanistan.
The only reason we suffered so much was because we became an ally of the U.S., of the coalition in the war against Afghanistan, where there were attacks being conducted from Afghan soil into Pakistan. At least there should have been a word of appreciation. But rather than appreciation, imagine how we feel when we are blamed for this, the turn of events in Afghanistan.
Pakistan sounded disappointed with what it called the ungratefulness of the West for ignoring its sacrifices in a war which people here always believed was not their war. Analysts believe that Islamabad is likely to get further closer to China and become part of the efforts to build up a bloc of regional countries in the event of U.S. economic sanctions on Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
It was the biggest state intervention in the U.K.'s labor market since World War II, introduced 18 months ago to help firms weather the economic storm whipped up by the pandemic. Popularly known as the furlough scheme, it's cost a whopping $94 billion. Without it, there are concerns that the job market will be flooded as job seekers need to find employment.
The young people in particular not doing well in this, but anybody on the borderline of low-paid jobs or into welfare benefit or an element of welfare benefit in their income, they are going to be hit very, very badly indeed.
Launched in March last year, the scheme was the brainchild of British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, covering 80% of a furloughed employee's wages. When it started, it helped save more than 11 million jobs. 18 months later, it was still supporting well over a million of them. The government is hopeful that the more than a million job vacancies will absorb workers coming off furlough. Critics say the decision to wind up the scheme will only intensify Britain's economic woes.
And there's going to be about 1.6 million people who are going to be unemployed, losing their jobs. And they will not be able to find jobs necessarily in other sectors of the economy. There are several reasons for that. Partly there's a lack of skills matching, and also because the conditions of the virus have taught people how bad so many of the jobs were. They were not full-time jobs. They were temporary, insecure, low-paid jobs. And a lot of people do not want to go back to those situations.
But it's not just the ending of the furlough that is a concern among Britons. A temporary increase in welfare payments, universal credit, and a moratorium on evictions for renters squeezed by the pandemic are also ending in October, at a time when consumers are facing a 12% rise in energy costs.
And all of that happening at a time when the country's economic recovery from COVID-19 is faltering, as announced by the Bank of England's governor just this week. And what that means for the people in Britain is that an autumn storm is on the way. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The funeral prayers for one of the 8 members of the Islamic movement killed by the Nigerian security forces was attended by aggrieved members. The movement said the 8 were cut down and killed when security operatives opened fire with live rounds during a peaceful trek of the Arba'in, an annual religious event undertaken by members of the Islamic movement.
They kill about 8 people, which we are sure that now, as they used to do normally, after they kill, they will carry the dead body away. So also, the same thing yesterday, they carried away the dead bodies, 8. It is only one of our Muslim brothers by name Shamsuddin Abdurrahman we were able to take away from them.
The Nigerian police have denied that any member was killed during what they described as a provocative trek. Press TV visited a health facility where many injured victims of the attack were receiving treatment from bullet wounds. Members of the Islamic movement have continued to express outrage at the persistent attacks by security forces whenever they come out for religious events.
The security agent in Nigeria, they have been paid. They paid their salary and they provide them with weapons to protect the life and properties of the citizens. But in these days, they are using these weapons to attack the citizens that they are supposed to protect. Our offense to the government of this country is just coming out to show, to practice our religion the way we understand it.
In a statement, Amnesty International has expressed grave concern over the murder of the 8 members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. It called on the Nigerian authorities to put an end to the deadly crackdown on members of the Islamic movement, which it says has been going on since December 2015. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Presidents of Russia and Turkey held their face-to-face talks since the beginning of pandemic. After the talks, the two leaders confirmed that the mutual ties developed positively despite some problems.
Our negotiations are not always easy, but with a positive final result, our departments have learned compromises that are beneficial to both sides.
Syria was among the main topics of talks between the two leaders. In Syria, Russia serves as the main supporter of the Syrian government, while Turkey backs anti-government groups. Despite this, the two countries have been cooperating in seeking a political solution in the country.
Peace in the Syrian region depends on Turkish-Russian relations. Our joint steps on the Syrian issue are of great importance. The steps we have already taken were correct and cannot be changed.
Last year, Turkey and Russia reached a ceasefire agreement to put an end to war in Syria's Idlib. Turkey is concerned that an escalation of violence in northern Syria may lead to a new influx of refugees across its borders.
The two sides have to make a balanced relation when it comes to Syria, but it is not an easy task amid plots by the US and its allies. For example, the US did not object to the delivery of humanitarian supplies to Syria through the territory controlled by the Syrian troops, and this was done with an attempt to knock Russia and Turkey head on.
The talks between Erdogan and Putin came after U.S. President Joe Biden refused to grant a one-on-one meeting with his Turkish counterpart on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly.
Another pressing issue in Russian-Turkish cooperation is Ankara's purchase of Russian S-400 missile systems. On the eve of his visit to Sochi, Erdogan told reporters that he rejects any foreign pressure regarding this issue and intends to go ahead with his decision to the system. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Some major international humanitarian agencies are warning about the consequences of the economic crisis in Afghanistan due to widespread joblessness, poverty, and U.S. sanctions on the country. Either war or unemployment has forced Hamid and hundreds of other families to flee their homes and get to Kabul in search of a better life. But contrary to their expectations, they are living here in this camp in northern Kabul for the internally displaced. They are living dire conditions and deprived of basic services.
We left our village in Baghlan province after the escalation of clashes back in July.
Now we are living here while we have no access to our basic needs, such as portable water, electricity, or healthcare services. Hundreds of people here are suffering from malnutrition as well.
Abdullah is another internally displaced man who also lives here with his family members. He says nor the Taliban, neither humanitarian aid agencies have so far met their needs. Therefore, he asks for implementation of a transparent supporting plan for people like himself and the rest of vulnerable Afghans who are suffering from hunger and malnutrition.
Humanitarian aid should be distributed among the neediest families like us. But so far, we have seen that most of those who are in charge of handing out humanitarian assistance are corrupt figures because they usually distribute the aid among their own relatives and friends.
Under such circumstances, the Taliban administration has also called on the international community and humanitarian aid agencies to resume their aid supplies to Afghanistan. This comes as some neighboring countries of Afghanistan, like Iran and Pakistan, have begun sending humanitarian aid to Kabul, a move that is widely welcomed by both the Taliban and ordinary Afghans, especially the internally displaced ones.
A rise in the number of internally displaced people has put pressure on Afghanistan. Moreover, Afghans are already denied access to their assets, as Washington has frozen them under the name of slapping sanctions on the Taliban. However, facts on the ground show that Washington's move has affected the lives of ordinary Afghans, especially internally displaced people, rather than affecting the Taliban. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Russia has warned NATO against setting up military infrastructure in Ukraine. It comes after Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said the United States is creating military bases in Ukraine under the guise of establishing training centers. Lukashenko said he has discussed the issue with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, and they agreed to take action to counter the growing NATO activity.
It's actions that will provide further strategic interests and security of our two allied states. The issue of potential expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine was numerously mentioned by President Putin, and President Putin said it was beyond the red line he had talked about repeatedly.
Moscow has time and again warned against NATO's expansion in Ukraine, saying it is a red line the West will regret crossing. Last week, Russia held large-scale joint military drills with Belarus. The maneuvers followed Ukraine's joint war games with the U.S. and other NATO member states. Tensions have been simmering between Moscow and Kiev since the ouster of Ukraine's elected president Viktor Yanukovych in a U.S.-backed revolt in 2014. The tensions further escalated after Crimea declared autonomy from Ukraine to reunite with the Russian Federation. The so-called revolution in Ukraine and Kiev's subsequent reach out to NATO could be part of a puzzle being pieced together by the United States and its allies to contain Russia militarily.
Yemen is half condemned what the Iraqi government has described as an illegal meeting held in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. The meeting demanded Baghdad join the so-called Abraham Accords and normalize ties with Israel.
We believe in the rights of the Palestinian people to liberate their land, and therefore we will stand against any attempt to normalize relations with Israel. The recent illegal meeting in the Iraqi city of Erbil is completely rejected. It's a desperate attempt after the failure of the so-called deal of the century. Palestine will be liberated and Israelis will be expelled.
Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour slammed the meeting, saying it is an attempt to drag the free people of Iraq to normalize relations with the Israeli regime, adding those who have normalized ties with Israel are part of the Zionist project in the region.
The normalization meeting that was held in Erbil, Iraq, is an attempt to drag the Iraqi people into normalization with the Israeli enemy and for Iraq to become part of the Zionist project, as some Arab rulers did last year. But the conference failed and was rejected by all the free and resistance forces in Iraq because it is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause and the Islamic nation.
The so-called Abraham Accords is a U.S.-led Middle East initiative aimed at establishing diplomatic relations and full normalization between Arab countries and the Israeli regime. This agreement was signed by Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and Sudan, and was welcomed by Israeli officials.
Yemenis have praised the Iraqi government's rejection of normalization of ties with Israel. They say the free people of the world will always support the Palestinian cause until the liberation of the occupied territories. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki is the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria known as the IMN. The top Muslim cleric and his supporters have been subject to a crackdown by Nigerian authorities over the past years. The most brutal attack took place in December 2015 in the northern city of Zaria, Kaduna State. The army opened fire on Zakzaki's supporters, killing hundreds, including three of his sons. The military accused the Sheikh's supporters of having tried to stop the passing convoy of the army chief to assassinate him. The IMN vehemently denied that accusation. During the crackdown, Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife suffered gunfire wounds. They were taken into custody under the pretext of protecting them from violence in Zaria. But they were later charged with culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, and disruption of public peace, among other things. A year later, the Abuja High Court ordered their release, but the Nigerian government defied the order. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife remained in prison until July 28th this year, when they were released after a Kaduna High Court dismissed all charges against them. The IMN welcomed the ruling, saying it is a victory of perseverance in the face of extreme persecution. Kaduna state officials later acknowledged in a report that the military had acted disproportionately in connection with Sheikh Zakzaki and the Zaria massacre, and that the soldiers involved should be punished. No one has so far been prosecuted over the incident.
British government considering sending in army personnel in an effort to alleviate the fuel crisis that has seen back-to-back queues or empty forecourts across the UK over the past days. Drivers across the capital especially have been involved in a desperate game of trying to beat their neighbour to a petrol station that was still lucky enough to have some fuel left.
I basically just ran out of fuel, but I've been trying several of them, and then everyone just been shutting down. So it's quite bad, really. You know, I mean, I never thought, you know, I mean, we're going to run out of fuel. I thought maybe one day we're going to run out of food, but not of fuel.
This morning, we are supposed to have a delivery because due to shortage of drivers, we couldn't get a delivery. It has been postponed till tonight now. To be honest with you, since the Brexit, this thing has happened, like, you know. A lot of drivers have gone back home, like, and hence there is a shortage in the haulage industry.
It's empty forecourts like these that will no doubt be causing political anxiety for the government. But none will be more stressed than the British consumer, who might be wondering where might they get the next full tank in order to make it to school, to make it to work, to make it through the day.
The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, is keen to describe this not as a crisis exacerbated by Brexit, but one manufactured by the haulier industry, who says they need over 100,000 extra drivers to meet current need. There's also been a degree of blame placed at the feet of the consumers for panic buying and driving up demand unnecessarily.
There's no shortage of the fuel within the country, so the most important thing is actually that if people carry on as they normally would and fill up their cars when they normally would, then you won't have queues and you won't have shortages at the pump either.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already announced a three-month visa scheme to tempt experienced EU HGV drivers back to the UK to assist until Christmas, and the role the army could play is also being explored.
We are bringing MOD trainers in to accelerate some of the HGV training. To clear a backlog of people who want to carry out those tests, so there's definitely a role there for the MOD.
In the meantime, consumers want a guarantee that they are not left stranded, And if that means driving miles in search of the precious fuel, it's a journey they're